Welcome to episode 91 of the Sentientism podcast, a podcast about what's real and what matters. The Sentientism worldview answers those two deep questions by committing to evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. In this episode, I talk to Mary Pat Champeau. Mary Pat is the Director of Graduate Programs at the Institute for Humane Education and faculty at Antioch University. Mary Pat has been in the field of education since 1979 when she began teaching as a Peace Corps volunteer in Niger. Before joining IHE, she worked in refugee camps in Asia and supervised culture and language programs for the World Trade Institute in New York. I'd love to know what you think of this episode and the 90 others. Don't forget to work through our back catalogue if you've found us recently. Every person who reviews and rates or shares our podcast with a friend helps us nudge a few more people towards more compassionate, rational thinking. Many thanks if you've already done that. You can find out more about Sentientism at sentientism.info, where you can sign up for email updates or just search for Sentientism on your favourite social media platform. You'll be made welcome in all of our global online communities. They're open to anyone interested in these types of ideas, not just sentientists. Thanks for listening. Good morning, Mary Pat. How are you?
I'm good, Jamie. How are you?
Yeah, great. Thank you. Well, it's such a pleasure to talk to you, and thank you for making the time to join this series of Sentientist Conversations.
I'm thrilled to be here.
Yeah, it's great. And we've talked a little bit before about sentientism, and I summarize it as evidence, reason, and compassion for all sentient beings. And I guess what it's trying to do as a really broad, basic worldview or philosophy is to answer two really deep questions we're going to drill into today. First being, what's real and how should we choose what to believe and how to hold our credences, if you like? And secondly, as importantly, what matters morally and who and what should we have compassion for? But I'm talking to people in these conversations who both agree and disagree with the sentientist philosophy, so feel completely unconstrained, and we'll see where we get to. It'd be fascinating to understand your philosophical journey. But before we do that, how would you best introduce yourself and your work for people who don't know you already?
Sure. I direct the graduate programs in humane education at Antioch University here in the States. And that is a partnership program with the Institute for Humane Education. I think you've had a few other guests on from the Institute.
I have. I've been so lucky to talk to Zoe Weil and Nandita recently as well, although I haven't published Nandita's yet, but by the time ours comes out, Nandita's will be out as well. So yeah, it's great to talk to them both. So you're the third.
Yeah, good. Yeah, so I've been doing that work for about 20 years, and this is a graduate program in comprehensive humane education, which is looking at the interconnections and also the intersectionality between environmental justice, animal protection, and human rights. So I know you and I spoke a little bit before this podcast. I'm just going to repeat myself now, so forgive that. But it is one of the only social justice education programs at the graduate level that includes animals as a population deserving of nonviolent treatment. So, you know, already when I saw the word sentientist, which was new for me, I felt the kind of kindling of resonance, like, yeah. Oh yeah, that's a good word to describe this, because in our graduate programs, which includes a doctoral program, you know, a lot of the students come in to this program and experience a sense of relief at having a place where they can actually be who they are in relation to non-human animals.
And I can imagine.
It's not something that in most cultures, or certainly in most cultural contexts, I mean, there may be some places where that's very welcome, but overall, you know, there's a way in which a lot of people who do care about non-human animals and other sentient beings are always kind of apologetically squeezing them in.
Yeah. It's like an afterthought or a tokenistic.
Yeah. Yeah. Even in the environmental movement, or certainly in the human rights movement. So anyway, you know, it's just to say that, you know, we are pretty centered in the questions that you're exploring in your work, we're exploring them too. It's in a little bit of a different context. So a lot of our students are already classroom educators, and some of them come in without any real experience in animal protection. You know, they might come in and just think, well, I love animals. Like, I have pets. They haven't really thought about animals in food systems or entertainment or experimentation or any of that. It's just kind of loving animals. But for the most part, the students already have a sense of, you know, it's one of the things that attracts them to this program and also to the field is, yeah, this is kind of a next level for us. When are we going to sort of open the circle of compassion to include, you know, not just ourselves and our families and our pets, but humans we've never met, animals whose lives may be, you know, sort of serving us in some way that creates harm and suffering. So, or an environment beyond what we can actually just see out our windows. And that's a big push for people, is to just keep including, you know, to keep expanding the way they think about their own role in the world as educators and as humans, as pushing the limits of what they already care about.
Yeah. Well, that, I mean, that program is so distinctive. And I can imagine for someone who already, it does feel a bit like a switch, right? What, once you've genuinely deeply recognized non-human sentient animals as, you know, moral beings in their own right, with their own perspectives and their own views, however poorly we might understand them, you suddenly feel like you're an alien living in a strange world, right? It's like, is there something wrong with me? Because nearly everybody else seems to have this radically different view, but I'm super confident I've got this right. They are moral patients, they count, they matter. So I can imagine the sense of relief of someone who feels that way, you know, joining your program and going, you know, maybe I'm not crazy after all. And I think we'll come back to this later in the conversation as well, because you talked about intersectionality and you talk about social justice, and in a way, for people who are heavily invested in those ways of thinking when it comes to humans, I find it even more frustrating that they can't see the next level of oppression that's going on. You know, they will robustly resist all oppressions in their mind, but they're only oppressions of other humans. And there's this vast swathe of problems that they remain blinkered to. But I think we'll come back to that later in the conversation, but it's almost another level of frustration. You know, there are people who aren't invested in social justice or intersectionality or aren't that worried about human oppressions. You can sort of understand why they might not add non-human animals to the list. But if someone already feels that rich, extensive compassion for one species, almost doubles down on the frustration sometimes.
Yes. I mean, even in the animal protection realm, you know, you have people that are doing animal rescue or working in animal shelters. And the fundraisers for those organizations are a barbecue.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, the disconnects are profound, right? And then we also have on the other side of that, students that come in who have come in through the portal of animal protection and animal rights. You know, that's why they're here. That is their life's work. And until they take our human rights course, I mean, I've had a number of students after human rights say, okay, like, you know, humans deserve compassion too.
Yeah, it's another eye-opening.
Yes. We are all, you know, it's where the systems thinking piece comes in. You know, there are certain mental models that drive these systems that exploit animals and humans, especially marginalized humans, and degrade the environment.
Yeah.
You know, if we just keep hopping from issue to issue, we don't see it. But once we start really looking, you know, as like what you're exploring, as we really start looking at the mental models and the mindsets and who we have centered in our own narratives and our cultural narratives, and how does that limit us? How does the centering of humans always in the narrative and certain humans Like, let's say, you know, racially, certain humans in other human narratives, or ableism in other narratives. I mean, anyway, it's a system. It's all about the systems and these models that drive them.
I love it already, but we're already answering the final question at the end of the conversation about the future. But I think what I would say is that, and you're hinting at this already, in a way, many of the problems we're facing in this world are a lose-lose-lose for humans, non-human animals, and the environment. And the flip side, the opportunity of that, is that there are some really obvious win-win-wins across those dimensions as well.
Yeah.
That's one of the things that's blown my mind as I've learned more and more about, you know, how these different topics link together. So, but before we come back to fixing all the world's problems, which, you know, I could spend 2 hours talking to you about, I'm gonna drag you back to your own philosophical journey. So that was a great intro, and I think we'll learn more about your, you know, fascinating history and different things you've done around the world as we go through the stories as well. But the first question we'd like to come to is, what's real? And how should we go about understanding this crazy universe we all share? So for some of my guests, that's a story about whether they grew up originally in, you know, a fairly naturalistic, scientific-minded, maybe atheistic or agnostic sort of context, one that was more religious or supernatural or spiritual or a mix of the two, and how that side of their thinking about, you know, what's real and the nature of the world has changed over time. So you can wind the clock back as far as you like, but it would be fascinating to know your story on epistemology, if you like.
Yeah, I am a hardcore, long-term, no doubt about it, recovering Catholic. I am the oldest of 7 children in a large Irish.
Is the hardcore and long-term the Catholic bit or the recovering bit? Anyway, you're about to tell me.
I mean, there's no real moving beyond it, but it certainly has shaped my trajectory.
Yeah.
So, and I'm not rejecting my upbringing out of hand. Well, rather than jump into the whole ocean, I'll try to wade in, but I have a large Irish Catholic family. And I was raised completely in that context in upstate New York and Buffalo and lots of different places, actually. But a lot of the formative years in a little neighborhood in Buffalo, New York, where everybody was the same. It was all little houses, big families. My mother is the youngest of 10. Her brothers became priests. We have nuns, you know, the ones that didn't have 6, 7, 8 kids. I have, so this went to Catholic school. So it was really, I remember George Carlin, the comedian, talking about how he thought there were basically 2 religions in the world growing up, the Catholics and the publics. Like the Catholics went to the Catholic school and the publics went to the public school. And that's how it was for us too. And we kind of looked down on the publics because they, you know, were going to go to hell, unbeknownst to them. So there was this very strong religious piece to it and to my whole upbringing. And I have all, because I was born in 1957, I went through the 60s in Catholic school. And I've often mentioned, even when with students, they always write their educational autobiography. And I often kind of write mine too when they do it, just to see what, if you do that often enough, it's interesting what comes up. What was our, you know, our schooling like and things like that. And I think of all the things that happened in the 60s that in the context of this small Catholic school, it never touched us. You know, it never really touched us.
Like, you're insulated from the 60s.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember my babysitters going to Woodstock and feeling like that was like so exotic and, you know, all of this. And it wasn't until really, I mean, I went to public high school, but it wasn't until I took this course, World Religions, and there was a book called The Religions of Man. It's this little book. And actually, it's 2 books, like The Religions of Man. And then later, we talk about animal awareness. I read another book that you've already alluded to something really interestingly, but maybe we'll get to that, like where that awakening comes in terms of the animals. But I read Religions of Man. And, you know, it was my first year of college, and it was a Catholic college, and I had a Franciscan friar. I had a monk for that class. And I read this book, and Catholicism was only one of the religions in the book. And it wasn't like I was completely clueless, but I found it so bizarre that they were treating like the story of the virgin birth and Adam and Eve as a myth. And I said to the professor, who was a religious scholar, you know, why is Catholicism in this book? Like, I couldn't even really quite wrap my mind around the fact that it was right there in the table of contents with Buddhism and Judaism and Hinduism and all these, you know, Islam. And I said, I objected to that to him. And he very wisely said, you know, I understand, just do the work in the course, like, just go with it, you know? So anyway, not to get that, but that was like my first, you know, like, okay, like, I am out of at least hopping on the side of the nest. Like, I'm a little bit looking, oh, there's a lot of nests out here. Whoa.
You realize there is a nest now.
Yes, exactly. I've been in a nest. So anyway, I later, though, I mean, I have to say that we were mostly, although we were religious Catholics, we were big time cultural Catholics, a lot of social service, a lot of donut breakfasts for of all kinds of people arriving. We sponsored families from Vietnam. We, you know, we had people staying with us quite often, and we didn't have much, but we had unofficial, like, foster children. I mean, when I think about it now, it probably should have been in jail. Like, the church was always giving, you know what I mean? So I later came, I always kind of appreciated that. But later, living in, as a Peace Corps volunteer in 1979 to 81 in Niger and West Africa, it's this pretty, very traditional Muslim country. I was grateful for my Catholic upbringing, so I could totally relate. I could relate, like, I could keep Ramadan because it was like Lent. And I understood why women were in the back of the mosque. Women, we had to wear hats to church. There were no women priests. There were, you know, I felt people prayed five times a day. They had prayer beads. We had rosaries. The griot woke us up every morning with this call to prayer. And it felt to me like church bells. You know, I felt like, yeah, I felt like a real connection. So although I had rejected sort of by that time, majorly had rejected Catholicism politically. And, you know, I was awake to a lot of different things by the time I was a Peace Corps volunteer. I still now feel grateful for this vocabulary of my traditional Catholic upbringing.
Yeah. And would you say that you've turned away from the supernatural belief elements of it, or do you still hold those as well as, you know, the themes of compassion and community and ritual? I mean, and again, if you're not comfortable answering any of these questions, take
I'm
it in a different direction.
But asking and answering anything, it will be more a matter of putting a fence around it.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
Not go on too much. But, you know, I love the stories. I mean, I don't believe in angels or devils, although I grew up believing that one was like crying on my shoulder and one was dancing on the other, like depending on the choice I made. And I don't believe that there is a God whose son came down and, you know, saved us from ourselves. And I grew up praying to get babies out of limbo and my grandfather out of purgatory for some of his that kind of thing. But I see all of those things as sort of iconic representations of our psyche. You know, it's just like the pantheon of all these ways we've projected it into some kind of supernatural or physical form, the things that we couldn't quite explain and maybe still can't, that are part of our human makeup, and I believe are probably part of the non-human makeup as well.
Yeah, thank you. No, that's a beautiful explanation. And one of the things that's been interesting for, I guess, my journey, but many of the conversations I've had where people have moved at least to some degree towards a more naturalistic way of thinking, is for some people, there's been the sort of facts, the evidence bit. You know, they've read the Bible, they've learned about other religions, they've seen the inconsistencies, they've just gone, doesn't really feel that likely to me, you know, or the heaven, the hell, the deistic stuff, and some of the stories. And for me, you know, I had a similar experience of reading a book like that in my early teens, where it just became clear to me that these are things that are very much more likely to be been made up by humans, mostly men, a long time ago, than they were really a manifestation of the real world. So in that sense, you know, they're more about human psychology and needs and ritual and cultures than they're really being a man with a beard up there. So there's a pattern there. But one of the other interesting balances has been on the ethical and the moral side, which we'll come to next, because sometimes people haven't necessarily engaged intellectually with the fact of the matter. You know, is there a God? Did Jesus get reincarnated? Did Muhammad really fly on a winged horse? You know, whatever. They didn't necessarily push away for that, but they saw, as they looked at the ethical practices of different religions, their own and others, on the one hand, as you've said, some wonderful stuff like community, identity, genuine compassion, generosity, and richness. And then they saw some other things you've hinted at. You know, there are no male priests. You know, there's sexism. Maybe there's homophobia. Maybe there's anti-Semitism. Maybe there's, you know, unfair restrictive practices. Maybe there's, you know, I don't know if you came across this in Africa, but, you know, the role of the Catholic Church in, you know, women's reproductive rights in across the continent, which, you know, obviously I had a great conversation with Nandita about. So there's good and there's bad, but quite often it's that, you know, quite a lot of the bad stuff that has been another force that's pushed people away. So, and it feels to me that you really value richly the positive aspects that pulled through that culture and that religious way of thinking. How do you deal with the more negative stuff?
Of the Catholic Church, you mean?
Yeah, a Catholic Church, but other religious ways of thinking, I guess, as well.
Well, first, can I ask you what the book was?
Well, for mine, it was actually History of Western Philosophy by Bertrand Russell. So it wasn't just about religions, but, you know, it's set. And there are, you know, I'm not a philosopher, but, I've, you know, I've learned there's flaws and problems in his own perspective when he wrote that book a long while ago as well. But at least it's set a really broad, long-term historical arc across lots of different civilizations. And you could just see the different religious movements evolving in those contexts in a very human way. So that was the context that, yeah, made me see, I guess, my own nest and all the others and, you know.
Great.
Come to
Great.
See that God was much more made in the image of man than the other way around.
Yes. Yes. I think it makes it, I feel a little bit like, you know, when we think about systems change, like I think of it like a teacher in a classroom is going to have a very different way of thinking about how to take down the system of schooling that's not working or how to change it because there's boots on the ground. And then somebody else equally valuable looking at that system from way outside and saying, look, there's inequity, this is rife in the system. There's toxicity, this is doing harm. But I feel like I'm the classroom teacher with boots on the ground. You know, I reject the structure of the Catholic Church. It's like the largest landowner, I think, in the world. There's all the issues. We don't even really have to, I don't feel in any way defensive about them. I feel grateful for this little nugget of awareness that I have around what drives people who believe, who have deep faith. And a lot of the writers that I love, like you mentioned, Bertrand Russell, like a lot of the writers that I love had that, either still have it or rejected it. You know, I just recently was reminded of Wordsworth saying that, you know, very often we can reach more closely to the divine by stooping than by soaring. And I put that right in the context of the work we're doing at IHE in terms of racial justice. We have to approach that with deep humility. You know, like, so there's this way in which the spiritual aspect that has grown out of what didn't feel very spiritual to me as a kid. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It was just so like, it was so lacking in that, strangely. I remember, if I don't, I'll tell a little story of being in a church with in an Easter vigil when my uncle, who's a priest, was still alive and he was there. And I was with my own daughter who was about 8, and they were not raised. I mean, they know they have a large Catholic family, but they were not raised Catholic. And she was going around the Stations of the Cross, which is the journey of Jesus with the cross on his back and going. And she was looking at it and she was completely like heartbroken. She said his mother had to watch him. Like, they put that crown of thorns on his head, and then his mother had to watch him carry the cross. And she was like, you know, her eyes were puddling. And I thought, oh, I have looked at that a million times in my life. I never felt a thing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I never felt the human.
It's funny, isn't it?
Yeah. Like the human impact of that story, which is such an important story for all of us, right? Life often kind of crucifies us. And then if we're lucky, I think sometimes that leads us to a spirituality and we resurrect, like we rise out of that. It's a lot of times you find spirituality in your most adverse moments. You don't know where else to turn and you're going deeply. So I think I veered far from the question, but I think in wrapping it, it's that I easily reject the negative parts and work against them, you know, to keep educating for the fact that homosexuality cannot be criminalized in places where, you know, we have exported these religions that are no longer really even relevant here, that have experienced the disillusion of the masses in many ways in this country, in other ways not. I won't get into all of that, but you know what I'm saying? It's like, I think education is needed to take down these, many of the systems that religions have created.
Yeah, I agree. And I like the way you put that, because you don't have to just accept the whole package or not accept the whole package. Clearly, some people do, right? If people have a more fundamentalist mindset about their religion, you know, they're all in and it's inerrant and there is no questioning it, and that's the end of the story. I don't think we need to do that, but I also don't think you need to throw everything away either, because I think you can take value in that compassion and the community and the ritual and the connection and the power of some of the stories, whether or not you think they were factually true. There's still some resonance and narratives there that really matter. And I think there's a bunch of different paths to it, because, you know, I think I have the same sense of awe and wonder and connectedness that some people would call spiritual, even in a completely hard-edged naturalistic worldview. I mean, I'm just overawed by the wonder of the reality around us. But I think that does for me exactly what someone else's religious faith might do for them. So I think there's value in that. And as long as we are, I think this comes on to the second part of the conversation, but we are thinking expansively and compassionately, that's the framework that helps make sure we don't get dragged into or taken down some difficult moral pathways by a supernatural religious way of thinking. Because I think most religions at different speeds, at different paces across the thousands of sects, they are developing and they're maturing. And I think on average, they're probably improving, because whether they'd like to admit it or not, they are moving towards a more humanistic or even sentientistic way of thinking, right? Is it more in compliance with modern liberal ethics? And arguably is moving further and further away from some of the elements of the original texts. And I wholeheartedly support that. That's the sort of boots on the ground, have these movements develop, enhance, improve, get more compassionate, get less oppressive, you know, stop threatening children, they're going to burn in hell for eternity if they break a rule, that type of stuff. So I think that boots on the ground development is entirely positive. And this might be challenging, because I have this nagging sense that still worries me at the back of my mind that even if we could take, you know, religion like Islam or Christianity and we could strip out all of the negative ethical stuff, make it completely compliant with a modern sentientistic ethic that is universally compassionate in every respect, I think that would be an enormous step forward. I still have this niggling thing at the back of my mind that if we're open to believing things without evidence or reason to back them up, like, you know, faith in a pure sense, right? I don't need evidence. I just choose to believe. My worry is that even in that circumstance, there is a risk we leave the door open, because if we acknowledge that that style of thinking is valid, we've got no ground to stand on when someone else comes forward and says, you know, I'm going to do this terrible thing and God told me to do it. And we can't say, well, where's the evidence for this and what supports it? If we in turn also have an arbitrary, unfounded belief, even if it's a positive one. So I'm being uncharitable, because in a way I completely appreciate this boots on the ground evolution of religious and supernatural worldviews in positive ethical directions. But I've still got this sort of purist thing in the back of my mind going, I still would really like us to stick to evidence and reason all the way down the line. But
yeah. I mean, I think it's a really important area of nuance to explore, because I think there are some ways we can be in denial about actually in my, you know, as if we as humans could be so compartmentalized, say, okay, I put all that down and I've just taken what's good and that's what I'm going to bring in the world. So we may be telling ourselves that there is a way that, you know, there's in the Catholic Church, and I think in the Bible in general, like, it's easier for a rich man. What is it? It's easier for a camel to pass through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to enter heaven. And that is kind of an anti-intellectual, that is like the rich man is like, you know, if you are intellectually rich, you know, if you are eating from the tree of knowledge, like, that's going to hold you back. Like, we're up against this way, I think, in which a lot of religions really, really depend on people rejecting out of hand the notion of reason and rationality, because it's diametrically, it's an obstacle to their afterlife, which is like in the magical kingdom, pardon me. So I think, you know, you're really right. And yet, realistically, you know, I feel like, what did we do? Like, as soon as, you know, at the dawn of human existence, we looked up and saw the sun and like worshiped it. Like, there's something in us that we would have to evolve out of if there wasn't that resting place of faith, of like, okay, just tell me what to do. This is what our need to do that, you know?
Yeah.
Could that become
the hunger
nature?
For certainty, the detection of agency when there is no agency there. Yeah. These are deep-seated things. Yeah.
Yeah. And God will provide.
Yeah, yeah. And that drive for, you know, simple, reassuring answers, which is pretty powerful, right? We all feel it. So I think that's an interesting balance. And I think what I'd like to hope is that we can recognize those aspects of our personality and our psychology that are very deep-seated, but we can still find ways of, instead of just shutting them down and saying, you know, be rational, right? We can still find ways of meeting those needs in a way that isn't based on fabrications and certainly isn't based on harmful ethics. And I think, you know, I think that's doable, actually. I think that's a path that we can walk. I think there are some people who say, I want to deny that part of our nature. We have a super cold, perfectly scientific, cut and dried, you know, here's the evidence. We know everything. No space for any mysticism or humility. The other extreme is to say, I don't believe that stuff, but our need for it is so deep. Let's pretend we do. And I'm like, well, really? That's quite disappointing to have to, you know, pretend you believe in something you know is a fiction, because we can do better, right? And I do think there is a middle ground where we can have humility, we can have openness, we can understand the nature of our psychology and those deep-seated needs, but meet them through something that with humility still uses evidence and reason and compassion. I guess that's one of the things I'm hoping we can find a way forward. But it does need humility, right? Because there's a risk, even with it, that naturalistic scientific worldview, that even that can become quite dogmatic and fixed and closed and cold. And and lose a lot of what is wonderful about being a human sentient.
Yes. It's, look at where science had us 200 years ago. There is that sort of essentialism that we have to be careful of, everything has to have an evidence base. You know, if we stuck with that, then we would still be like using leeches.
Exactly. You know what I mean?
It's like, because that's also evolving. So it's more like, rather than this fixed dogma of religion, which gets reinterpreted, we aren't still doing the Spanish Inquisition, but we are doing versions of it. Like, when you think about the dominant role organized religion has played in the history of warfare, like, that alone should be jettisoning us, out of, like, as far away from that as we can get if we're peace-loving creatures that want to survive. And yet, that continues.
Yeah, I agree. And just as, I think we both hope that, religious supernatural ways of thinking and worldviews will continue to evolve in more compassionate directions. A naturalistic way of thinking, has to have that at its heart. That, to my mind, that is the most important essence of a naturalistic worldview, is having that humility, because without that, you won't listen to the new evidence. And yeah, science is always, people talk about it progressively getting less wrong, but we should never have the confidence that we're right. It's about probabilistic credences and provisional beliefs, not ending our exploration or our understanding. That's part of the fun. So
yes.
Let's move on to, one of the things I find fascinating about these conversations is some people think this sort of what's real question and the what matters question are completely separate things, right? There's this Hume is ought distinction and, there's no relation between the two. I don't subscribe to that view. I think that chasm is either irrelevant or quite easily crossed. And we found it in this conversation already. It's almost impossible to talk about, one without the other. But if we come on to the what matters question, and you've hinted at some answers already, but there's two parts to this question. One is, what is our morality, our ethics really grounded on at its root? If we keep digging down and go, but why does that matter? What's at the bottom? And the second question, which again, you've already hinted at, is about moral scope and the extent of our compassion. And how did that start off when you were very young growing up? And how did that, moral circle, if you like, or that moral scope develop over time? So yeah, again, two crazily big questions, but answer them however you like.
So could you say a little bit more about that first one, about what matters? Could you say a little more?
So I guess some people would say there's no such thing as a grounding to ethics, right? But other people would say, this is what my ethics are based on. So there's a few alternatives people might follow. One, if they do have a supernatural or religious worldview, quite often that will come packaged with a moral system. So they'll say, good and bad for me are about whether we are, doing what God wants us to do because God is the perfect being, or it might be because we're following the rules in the Quran and the Hadiths or the Bible, so we need to comply with those things. That's what defines good or bad. If you put that sort of system to one side, so that's more about divine command theory or compliance or obedience or, mirroring God's wishes, then there are a bunch of different ways you can take that approach in a naturalistic worldview as well. So some people will say nothing matters, right? Because there isn't anything supernatural telling us what's good or bad. Nothing matters at all. It's a sort of nihilistic view. Another view is relativistic, where people will say, it sort of depends which culture agrees what. So in a way, anything goes, as long as the culture thinks it's right, then who are we to judge? And then I guess my flavor is grounded in a sort of naturalistic understanding of what it means to be a sentient being. In simple terms, I don't like suffering. I'm pretty sure you don't either. And morality is my choice to care about that. So there's a sort of portfolio. There's loads of others as well, right? So some people would say their morality is egoism, where, the only thing that matters is doing what they want. There's a whole list of different ways of thinking about what right and wrong is, but yeah, so it's a crazy question to ask in a way. But
it's a good question, and I'm in your camp.
Yeah.
I would give that same type of answer if I had, articulated it, in the elevator speech. Like, I think that there was some point, and maybe this happens to everybody in a different in different way and about different things. But there was definitely a point at which, and I think it began as like a 17-year-old, and this as the other book was Stranger in a Strange Land, the science fiction book, and Michael Valentine, yes. And that became like a little bit of a 70s cult. People were grokking and you had Water Brothers. And that book, the thing I took from it was he looked the alien kind of as you mentioned comes and he sees all these like amazing animals and he can't believe people eat them. He's like, you do what? And it just was like in that way that it can happen at 17. I was like, yeah, that's dumb. I'm not doing that anymore. But I didn't know anybody else, you know, it was the early 70s. I didn't know anybody who was a vegetarian. I didn't know. I would just go to McDonald's with my friends and get a Big Mac without the meat. Like I didn't have any idea how to do it.
Before you were 17, did you have relationships with non-human animals? Do you have companion animals in the home?
Just
or
a dog who I feel like was just treated the way the rest of us were, like, you know, it was like a chaotic, little bit of a chaotic household. And the dog, we loved a dog, but you know, never thought about it. Never, ever thought about it.
It was that book that made the connection to the food on your plate and
everything. It's just like so simple. That's so dumb. And I didn't even really, it wasn't like I wanted to then go and adopt a bunch of animals or go and work. I was like, for me personally. So I think this was the moment that I mean, like what you were saying is that I sort of like, I just drifted. Maybe the first one was saying, oh, I'm in a nest. And I'm at, now that we've had this conversation, it's an interesting way to think about it. But at that point, I like removed from everybody else I knew because I didn't know anybody who was a vegetarian. And I didn't see it as a big moral stance, but I did begin to see like, wow, like we all read this book. We read it for a class. Like we all read this book. Didn't you think how weird, like, that didn't have the same effect. And I began, you know, then slowly but surely, I mean, I just for a long time just kept that ethic. And it felt like it put me in the realm of questioning other things like gender identity, gender equity. I mean, I didn't even have that language, certainly not. This was still women's liberation back then, and they weren't even including lesbians. Like this was, you know what I mean? Like there's so much. But like little by little, I began to identify with the people that were removing themselves that seemed to me to represent human progress. There was no doubt in my mind that trying to conserve the status quo was a death. I wasn't interested in it. I saw it as boring and square at the time. This was the 70s. There was a lot of cultural approval then, and I totally went with it to as much as I could in my sheltered way at the time of life. For I was reading different things than my friends. I was trying to do everything I could. You know, I got a passport. I out of college, I went to Europe and I didn't actually go to school the way I was supposed to. I started traveling with these people I met from Lebanon. Like I wanted to find a people. I wanted to find a group that was further seeking, you know, Kerouac, like their boss said further, like they just kept going. That was how I identified. It was like, we need to just keep doing this, you know?
Yeah, breaking boundaries, removing blinkers.
Yeah.
Opening your mind.
Yeah. Sticking it to the man.
Yeah. And was it difficult? Because it sounds like you sort of had to make a break with the community and the friends you were part of because the lights didn't go on in the same way for them. Was that a tough transition to make?
No, I didn't even see it that way. I mean, I did feel like, wow, I can't believe they didn't see this, but it didn't put a distance. I just felt like, okay, wow, okay. Maybe I felt a little superior. Like, whoa, they're not even seeing this? What? You know what I mean? But I didn't, I still had the same friends. I didn't, you know, I would go to Thanksgiving dinner and get on my soapbox about it and be like, uh-huh, whatever. It was like, you know, I didn't, I just slowly, as I became an adult, I just slowly moved toward other people who saw things the way I did. And I found them in different spheres, you know, and mostly like sort of overseas. Like I felt like not just Niger, but, and later I came back to New York and I went to grad school. Then I went to work in refugee camps in Indonesia and Thailand. And these were other Europeans, other Asians, you know, the people I worked with, most of whom, most of us were not living in the countries of our birth, including the refugees and the people that I worked with. They were, so we were in this like a little bit of a rarefied, you know, situation where nobody, it was really important to think outside the box. It was important to be constantly fluid if you wanted to be effective and sensitive and learning from what was going on. And I felt like you had to be supple and learning a lot about the impact of American policies and the wars in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia and learning about colonialism in Africa. And I didn't know. I didn't know in that way. And so that just, you know, I saw those people that were outside of what, how I had been raised, basically.
Yeah. And it's interesting because people have these sort of moral scope journeys in different ways. So for me, I guess I went through the sort of expansion of scope to human, to all humans globally, at least in concept, first, you know, through a variety of usual stuff, just learning things and meeting different types of people and travel and your mind expanding and realizing, you know, basically we're all human, we all matter. And my thinking about non-human sentience developed, you know, later than that as a sort of another wave. For some of my guests, it's almost been the other way around. So they've started out from a sort of fairly traditional context, and their compassion for non-human animals, partly through experiences with companion animals or sometimes experiences with a farm, you know, jumped to a compassion for non-human animals much more quickly first. And then the universal compassion for all humans came as well. For you, it sounds like those things sort of happened at the same time. So when you were 17 reading Stranger in a Strange Land, your compassion included the non-human animals, but it was a similar time when you were, you know, starting to travel and explore. And is that fair to say that your sort of moral scope expanded across the non-human and the human scope at the same time-ish?
It's like an exciting thing, right? I mean, maybe you felt this when you read Bertrand Russell, or when you're traveling, you feel like suddenly I'm the only person who can make me think differently is me. Like, how cool is that? Like, you actually, I felt so like excited. I didn't even really know the word empowered. I mean, I probably didn't think of it that way, but it seemed so exciting that there was so much beyond what I knew. I didn't see any of it as a threat to what I already believed. And I think partially because I'd already like seen this thing with the animals, like, whoa, what's, I remember even having like a discussion with my uncle who's a priest. He was like, I appreciate your missionary zeal. Like I was trying to talk to him about like.
He could see the talent. He just thought you were misdirected. He's like, I could use that.
Exactly. It's like, all right, I'm, you know, like in the Bible, you know, in Genesis, like, look, does the fruit of the trees should be our meat? Like, no, it doesn't say anywhere in the Bible that we're supposed, like, I was still in this context of trying to convince in my own little realm, like trying to convince, oh, well, he represented that, you know, like I thought, oh, if I can influence these people, I understand how they think. This was probably my hubris. Like, if I can influence them, they'll change. Like I really did want everyone to change. I wanted people to stop eating animals.
Yeah, the inexorable power of logic and moral argument. If only it worked.
If only it worked. Like how
it does with some people. It does with some people.
Logic. Yeah, but it's not a big game changer worldwide. It's like
not fast
if
enough.
It were, we'd be in a very different, you know.
And I hate to drag you down from these sort of high intellectual concepts to the practicalities. But how different was it transitioning away from animal products in the 1970s, given compared to where we are now? Because we've got it so easy compared to...
Oh, my God. I was like, whenever I have students who say that, like, you know, how, like, I understand it's bad, but better. Like, I understand there's still so much work to be done on behalf of animals. But do you have any idea, like, what it's like? You can go to the smallest coffee shop in the smallest town here and get coconut milk. Like, what? You know, we were eating sawdust burgers.
Were you on powdered soya milk at the time, or were you?
No, because I wasn't vegan.
Yeah.
That came later. I was vegetarian. I didn't even know the word vegan until the late 80s. As soon as I heard it, like, this is kind of funny, but I saw vegetarian, and then I saw the word vegan, and I felt, this is the, like, the Catholic martyr in me. I was like, oh, what is that? Like, that seems even more limited than vegetarian, like, more extreme.
There's another level of purity I could achieve.
Like, yeah, exactly.
A radicalism, yeah.
I am going to heaven, man. I am going to be a vegan. So then I began that. But yeah, in the 70s, there was nothing. Francis Morlape had written Diet for a Small Planet about vegetarianism, which I tried to read. It was like physics. It was all about, like, combining proteins, amino acids. I was like, I just ate potato chips and apples and, you know, I mean. So now, like, you know, I could make, like, a bacon cheeseburger.
Yeah, made absolutely. Out of plants. Yeah. You can veganize pretty much anything. Yeah.
I know.
So before we move off this what matters question, one of the things I wanted to touch on before we talk about how we fix the future, and you've already told us, you know, quite a bit of that. We've talked about, you know, grounding, I guess, our ethics really simply and just having a concern for others, right? Having compassion for others. Suffering is bad, flourishing is good. You know, what's not to like, right? It's not particularly complicated. But then we talked about that moral scope going out to all humans and to non-human animals as well. And sentientism obviously is biased because it focuses specifically on sentience as a characteristic, which pretty much maps to human and non-human animals. Although with some of the simplest animals, like a sea sponge, has no nervous system whatsoever. So I'm pretty confident they're not sentient, even though they're an animal. So there's some wiggle room around the edges, but, you know, roughly it fits. So some people will push back on that and say, look, well, no, we need to be more anthropocentric. Humans matter, non-human animals don't. You and I would disagree vehemently. You know, all suffering should matter. But there are some people that criticize sentientism from the other side and say, actually, we need to go further than that. And obviously, given your work with the Institute for Humane Education, you talked about those three chunks, really, you know, non-human animals, human animals, and the environment as well. So some people will say, look, we need to go beyond sentientism to intrinsically grant moral consideration to, for example, you know, plants and the biosphere, biocentrism, or even broader than that, the ecosystem as a whole. And you mentioned systems thinking, right? Thinking about the earth as Gaia and ecosystems and habitats and species and rocks and rivers and so on. So how do you think about, you know, the non-sentient stuff and the systems, you know, how do you think about the moral implications of those entities and systems?
You have really good questions, Jamie. I think this is the first thing that comes to my mind, and I don't know that this is probably, like, I probably will regret saying this later, but you can always edit it out if it's totally out there. And that is, I think doing that is a way of sidestepping the harder work of recognizing non-human sentience in a certain way. I think it's easier for people to talk about the whole ecosystem, the whole planet, the whole earth. For me, it's a little bit like all lives matter. Like, it's easier than actually doing the moral investigation personally and culturally into how deeply and forever we have centered humans in all of these narratives. So, I mean, that would be my first thing. And whenever people say, what about the wheat? Somebody went through the wheat field with a scythe and all the wheat was nervous. I'm just like, okay, where does that come from? And also there's no central nervous system there. Nobody was nervous. And, you know, it's sort of like continuing to use whatever inane piece of anecdotal garbage somebody has heard to prevent themselves from looking. I think people have integrity. Like I'm a huge fan of people. I think a lot of times they don't want to look at animal sentience because they're just not ready to change. And they know that if they really look at it, they will have to. And it opening that so that questioning the things we hold dear, that the things we haven't even looked at, the things we're in denial about, like that exploration, making that exciting and not threatening, I think that is a big role for education. And that's what the direction I like to aim for.
Yeah, I agree. And I will dig into that in a minute before we wrap up, because I think that role of education in making a better future is absolutely foundational. But I completely echo everything you've said, because, you know, in a sense, I don't mind if people want to go beyond sentience, as long as they don't forget about the sentient beings. Because if you choose that you want to care about a carrot or a, you know, blade of grass, you do that if you like, but you have to acknowledge that sentience, the capacity to suffer, means something else over and above. So while I'd share a very rich, you know, concern for the environment and living things and trees and ecosystems, I care about those because of their impact on the sentient beings, not in their own right. And too often, I think you're absolutely right that people will jump to this sort of very expansive, you know, and arguably this is how the modern environmental movement, that's the central gravity of it at the moment, is, you know, jump to this very expansive, I care about the whole thing. And you scratch the surface of it and you really come back to a simple anthropocentrism all over again. And the narrative you'll find is, I care about the environment because, you know, I need to keep living here and so do humans. We need ecosystem services and I like the aesthetics because nature is pretty. So that's why I care about the environment. But beyond that, you know, there's a circle of life and we are a form part of these systems. And our human arrogance shouldn't lead us to think of ourselves as separate. And as part of those systems, life consumes life and predation is a natural part of nature. So, you know, pass me another bacon sandwich and a milkshake. And you're like, okay, now I see what you've done now. I see what you've done. Brilliant. Well done. So basically you don't need to change at all, but you can feel really warm about yourself because you have this rich environmental concern for everything, but you don't have to do anything because it's all part of the circle of life. Sorry, I'm getting snarky.
So true. It's true. It's really true. I mean, I think that this is the conversation that we have to have more and more because there is a lulling that happens, especially we have a climate crisis. You know, we are all, if we saw this as the crisis that it was, we would not be living the way we live. Like it's an existential threat, but factory farming is one of the biggest contributors to the climate crisis. So I think part of the difficulty and the danger of the conversation that says, I love all the planet, not just is we actually see that in some way as we can only choose one. Like, I just love all the planet and all that it includes. It's like people saying, how can you care about animals when children are suffering? Okay, it's the same systems that are driving that suffering, whether you're talking about children, marginalized people, women, the poor, whatever, and animals on factory farms. And we don't have to buy into this idea that you can't care about one thing as opposed to the other. But for me, that sounds like it. That big, broad swath that is kind of a general, like, I love everybody, but, you know, I don't want my daughter marrying that one. Like,
absolutely. But. Yeah. And I think you can see it. How it plays through in the environmental story, right? Because I think if you have a sentiocentric concern for the environment, you look to something like factory farming, and it's very simple. We just need to transition compassionately to end the whole thing, right? That's the answer. It's the answer for the non-human animals involved, but it's also the most impactful answer to the environmental impact of agriculture as a whole. You know, you could free up 3/4 of agricultural land. You'd radically slash all of our emissions. Pollution would drop. Land use, water use, blah, blah, blah. So one, it's compassionate. It's directed at, you know, the impact on the sentient beings, but also it's maximally effective, even in purely environmental terms. So that you put that to one side. Whereas if you have a more generic environmental concern that isn't motivated by sentiocentric compassion, you end up thinking, oh, maybe we could feed the cows a different type of seaweed, or we could train them to poo in slightly different places, or we can... And this is the tone, right? This is the tone. The tone is, the assumption is we have to keep these things going. You know, that's incontrovertible. There's no way we can stop these things happening. So let's just tune it around the edges, you know, put a slightly more efficient exhaust on my Lamborghini, but... You know, I'm not gonna make a fundamental change. So again, I'm sorry, I'm starting to rant again. I don't know what it is.
No. It's the solar panels on the coal plant, you know, that I always think of, like, okay, what are we sustaining? Like, we have to look at what we're sustaining. What mindset are we sustaining with our sustainability efforts? Do we really want to sustain what we've got? Or do we want to imagine into something that is worth sustaining? And I don't mean just like imagine the dream. I mean work toward creating what we actually think is worth sustaining.
Yeah, real solutions. And this brings us on to the final topic, which is, how do we make the world better? And you've talked already about, you know, you've hinted at the role of education. You've talked about these sort of win-win-win opportunities as you think across these three different domains. But how do you, you know, the big picture, think about, you know, what, I guess, what a better potential future might look like for all sentient beings, but also how can we drive and make that happen? And you can obviously play your amazing work at the Institute into that story.
Yeah. I mean, that's one reason I'm doing this. Like, when I discovered the Institute for Humane Education, I'd already been a teacher, you know, I started in 1979 and teaching in lots of different environments. And I loved education and I loved learning, like, you know, it's just like what's happening with us, right? Everything you say, I'm like, a new little thing is going off. Like, that's the same with students. And when I heard Zoe talking about humane education, I just went to, when we moved to Maine, I just went to this little, just for lack of something better to do, I went and went to a movie at the Institute and like listened to her talk about it. And I was like, oh, why didn't I think of this? This is the role of education. Why do we not use schooling to give kids the information they need to help themselves, other humans, animals, and the environment thrive? Why do I have graduate students who are 30? Like, I never really understood, you know, that milk was actually kind of bad for humans. Like, what, I mean, there's just so much. There's so much that, so we have this system of schooling, you know, that is this in the States, and I think in a lot of, you know, it's like this amazing system, free and appropriate education. It's also more segregated than it was at the time of, you know, desegregating legislation, Brown versus Board of Ed. But anyway, there's a lot of issues with it, but not just that, is that it's not just the issues with actual schooling, it's the content and the way teachers are trained. Like, I personally feel really optimistic. Like, I feel like we are in a big transition right now. I think that's why we're seeing so much bubbling up of this pull, this nostalgic pull toward the past, is because the winds are moving us on. And I think that's happening in schooling too. I think there's lots of ways to educate. There's educating through the arts. There's educating in schools. There's educating in writing. There's educating by the way we live, by conversations. But if we really, really, like, see ourselves as learning beings, that this is fun, that we don't have to develop an opinion and then drive it and concretize it, that we, if we keep pushing through and we really, really walk the path of the learner, no matter what we're doing, and we're open to this idea that our learning can actually liberate our own brain and other beings and the earth, like, innovation can happen. You know what I mean? It's really a belief in, I mean, I found this job because I love these students. I love these students and I love them. You know, everyone who comes, I am interested in what they do when they leave. I'm interested in what they do in the program. And people have such amazing ideas. And our theory of change, or at least mine, I haven't actually run this by them at the Institute, but it's like, you know, you put out the message as broadly as you can. And then you attract a subset of people who want deeper learning, who are going to take that into whatever path, wherever, whether it's classroom educating or healthcare or technology or whatever, they're going to take that into something else. And the basic message is include, keep including, expand and include, you know, and question your positionality. The margins, like we wouldn't have margins if we didn't have the center. We're always having to center something, and we're centering human concern for us. This is also small. You know, it's just so small, and it could be so big and juicy and inclusive and exciting. And so that's.
And I find that there's a strange dichotomy in a way. Maybe it isn't a dichotomy, because on the one hand, one of the big themes through your work, and I guess my thinking as well, is in a sense trying to decenter the human a little bit and just take the edges off the arrogance, you know, our insistence that we are at the center, at the foundation of everything, you know, that obviously played through a religious worldview, right? You know, we're God's special chosen one, you know, the whole universe was created for us. We are put in a position of dominion. But there are people with a naturalistic way of thinking who think the same thing too, right? You know, we're the most highly evolved, we're the most brilliantly cognitive, you know, we deserve just on our capability and our power to dominate. It's like, okay. So I absolutely want to take the edges off all of that stuff and decenter us in a sense. But at the same time, the fact is we do have amazing capabilities and breathtaking power, which we use for good and ill. So in a sense, your theory of change, which is saying, let's focus on those humans because they have an enormous amount of power, and let's help them develop and become, you know, compassionate, open-minded people, is almost pulling on the lever that's the sort of central, I do think it's one of the most foundational things you can do. And in a way, that's part of my, you know, amateur intent behind the sentientist idea, because some people will say, well, why are worldviews interesting? Why is philosophy even relevant? Why, you know, there are many more specific things we can go out and do, you know, to help people or to do X, Y, Z. But in a sense, if we can improve people's fundamental worldview, their grounding beliefs, their grounding ethics through human education, through talking about different worldviews, that impacts every single decision that human is ever going to take and everybody they're ever going to talk to and all of the ripples that flow from that. So I do like that way of, you know, one, a bit more human humility, but also recognizing our incredible power and then really focusing on trying to help humans be better. Yeah. And seeing what that does.
Yeah. And it makes, and what you've just said makes me feel also about the issue of privilege. Like, it doesn't actually do anybody any good if I, as like a white, cisgendered, educated female, deny my privilege. It will help if I use my privilege.
Yeah.
Right?
Use the power.
It's
use
like,
the.
Yeah. As a human, it doesn't help me to say.
Who would want you to just sort of slink away and hide quietly instead of
right.
doing what you're doing, right?
Yeah. Well, yes. And also just even as humans, right? So if we say like, okay, yeah, look, I'm just the same as a lobster, so I'm not going to do anything but sit around on the beach all day and wait to be caught.
Yeah.
I know that's not what you're saying, but you know what I mean? It's like,
yeah.
So humans, we create a lot of problems. We are our best hope.
I agree, right? But and you joke about the lobster, but that is a current of thinking, right? And I understand why. And it's quite prevalent in environmental movements and the animal advocacy movement and the vegan movement as well, because people have developed such a depth of skepticism about the human species. And I sort of understand why, right? You look at some of the things you've done and are doing, and yeah, sometimes it makes you want to give up on humanity, but some people have followed that through and they think the answer is therefore for humans to just stop, withdraw, shut down, you know, just don't get involved, don't do anything, give up in a way, you know, even disappear, right? You'll hear, you know, people on the sort of eco-fascist fringe talking about, you know, the humans are the virus and, you know, maybe a planet without humans would be better. And I'm like, I think you've gone too far the other way. You've got to find that way.
First of all, it's not going to happen. So it's one of those things also that is like, oh, okay, I know what the solution is. And it doesn't matter if it's never going to happen. It's like, then they're done. I know what the solution is. Humans have to disappear. Look what happened during the pandemic. The humans stayed inside and the animal world thrived. You know, it's just like, I've often felt like, especially, you know, in circles that are strong animal rights circles, like I need the t-shirt that says humans are animals too.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. This is the thing, right? We need universal compassion for all sentient beings, including humans, even humans we disagree with on Twitter. You know, even them. And it's tough. It's tough sometimes.
And ourselves. Yeah. Like, how is it too that, and I think this happens a lot with activism, especially we start running on anger, and you can extend all kinds of sort of abstract compassion that feels so real to non-sentient animals, to other, you know, let's say with animals, you know, you're so compassionate and you're terrible to yourself. I'm not doing enough. I haven't, you know, I need to. It's like you're not
the weight of the world on your shoulders.
Yes. And then who wants to be in that club? Who are you influencing? Where's the joy? You know, like we say, nobody wants to follow the martyr to the gallows. Like, you want to be really embracing the joyfulness of this path.
Yeah. And I think you need to do that, one, purely just to be effective in the world, but almost more importantly, just to show compassion to yourself, because you are a sentient being, you warrant compassion. So let's start there. And to your earlier point, there is this sense where some people will think humans bad, nature good. And they're wrong on both fronts, right? Nature is not good. Nature is amoral and brutal and often sickeningly awful, right? So do not trust nature to be nice to sentient beings by any means, right? And on the flip side, yes, much that humans do is bad, but there's an enormous amount of good that we can do too. And it, in a way, that's the balance, right? If we can improve humans with our power and influence, we can offset the human bad, but we can offset the amorality of nature too, and hopefully make things better for all sentient beings. But
yeah. Such a good point about nature. It's like our tendency to want to create, it's like the worship thing. Like, if we idealize
a romantic view of,
we idealize that, we don't actually have to. This is the stories, you know, we're always creating these fictions.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's been an absolutely fascinating conversation. Is there anything else you'd like to layer into what we've talked about? Anything else you want to tell us about the Institute and your work before we wrap up? Or?
You know, if you're interested in getting your degree in humane education, step into my office. Mary Pat, humaneeducation.org. No, I'm over the holiday, I'm hoping to listen to all 77 of your podcast episode.
Wonderful. Don't feel
interesting.
Well, don't feel any obligation. And also, it's now up to 86. Or it will be by the time. Yeah, it will be when I publish Nandita's episode. So
I love it. I'm just going to keep using the language. Sentient.
Well, I hope you don't. I'm so pleased that you're a listener and that the idea of sentientism resonates with you. And although I ask the same three questions every time, my guests are, you know, many and various and fascinating. So hopefully it's, you know, despite my participation, it's not too boring as you work through them.
No. Let me know how you're a great conversationalist, and those are great questions.
Yeah, I've been very lucky. Well, thank you so much. What's the best way of people following you, learning about your work? I'll include links in the show notes to your social media and the Institute, of course.
Our Institute and Antioch. We're at Antioch University. Yeah, I think following the Institute is the way to do it.
Yeah. Cool. Sounds good. Let's focus there. Well, thank you so much. It's been an absolute inspiration. You've put a big smile on my face. And thank you for being a guest on Sentientist Conversations.
My total pleasure.
And it's great to have you in our Facebook group too. Thank you. I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah. I'm sending people there.
Lovely. Take care. Right. I'll let you get on with your day.
Thanks, Jamie. Okay.
Thanks, Mary Pat.
Thanks for listening. You're helping to normalize rational, compassionate thinking. Don't forget to subscribe, leave us some stars or a review. You can visit sentientism.info to find out more, and you'd be very welcome in any of our online community groups. The biggest is on Facebook. If you like what we're doing, why not tell your friends about us?